Shabbat shalom, everyone. I trust the blessings of God are overtaking your lives. I pray that God's Spirit is moving in your families, in your homes, in your businesses. I trust that we are rising up even in the midst of a nation that's falling apart because God has placed His Son on the throne and He is ruling and reigning over the nations. And He's called us to rule and reign with them, which is a little bit about what I'm going to talk about today. I've entitled this teaching, The Breath of Life. You know, God is the giver of all good gifts. Every good gift comes from above. He's a good God and a good giver. And life is the chief of His gifts. It's the greatest of all the gifts. And those who have received life, well, we have a moral responsibility to thankfully receive it, to cherish it, to sustain it, to guard it, and to protect it. And we also have a moral responsibility to hold everyone else's life as sacred as our own. This is the first and highest gift of God. So in this teaching, we're going to take a closer look at what life is. We know it's more than just eating. It's more than just breathing. It's more than just sleeping. In fact, without a proper view of life, we will ultimately descend into the abyss of self-interests and corruption, misery, and ultimately death. So let's take a closer look at what life is all about, that we can choose life rather than death. So let's look at the image and likeness of God. In Genesis chapter 1, 26 and 27, a very popular verse, we're all familiar with it, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness.' So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them." This verse is preceded by the other verses that outline the creation. And God, who is infinite in power, infinite in wisdom, the one that is so far above us in every way, taxed Himself, all of His resources, for an incredibly long amount of time to create in stages a universe so complex, so intricate, so fine-tuned, so as to give it to us. He labored for a very long period of time, putting all of His effort, time, energy, wisdom into something so substantial for one reason. He's in love with you and me. He wanted to give something to us that was substantial, that spoke of His love. So after He created all this that we get to now explore and see and view and understand, He makes us. We are the crown of creation. He makes us in His own likeness, His own image. What that means is we were created free like He is free. What did God do? He did whatever He wanted to do. He did what was in His heart to do. He created something so beautiful so He could pour it out on those that He loves. And He did. And He made us free. And He's unleashed us, so to speak, to go and pursue the good that He's placed in our hearts so that we can be like Him and experience life like He is experiencing life. So we have this ability, like God, to relate to one another, to reason, to communicate. We have a moral compass, each of us. We know what's right and wrong deep down inside. And think about it. We're like Him in the sense that we're creators. Human beings, we are creators when you think about it, right? I mean, the first thing He tells us to do is create family. Very first thing. We'll get down to that in a moment. Excuse me. But think about this. There was a time in which we did not have an alphabet. Just the creation of an alphabet was just like genius level stuff. It gave us the ability to communicate in ways that we had not done before. That was an amazing thing that we came up with. And then, I don't know, did you see the movie with Tom Hanks? I think he was stuck on an island somewhere forever, right? What was the name of that? Castaway, yeah. So he finally is able to make a fire. Remember that? And you know, it's kind of life or death for him. It was an existential kind of scenario. but he creates fire. Remember his excitement? He says, fire, fire. For him, it was a game changer, right? Do you realize there was a time that we didn't know how to do that? That was a game changer for humanity. That was like when we discovered the wheel and what the wheel did to transform us as a people. The wheel. And then electricity and how that changed society forever. The printing press, combustion engines with the railroad, the car, the airplane, the powered ship, arts and entertainment. Just think of what we do in communicating and changing our world through art, literature, movies, dance, music. We are creators. We're like our Father in heaven. And then technology. Man, I mean, technology is just unbelievable in what it has given us in terms of abilities to do. It's amazing. We're in his image, in his likeness. We're creators like he is. At Babel, when they all gathered together and they refused to go and do what he called them to do in Genesis, and then later he told them, come on, get on the bandwagon here. Go, spread out, fill the earth, right? Take and extend Eden throughout the world. They said, no, we're going to stay here and build a big tower. You know, God looked down and he said that, you know, probably the same divine council that was in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. He looked down and he says, well, you know, Houston, we have a problem. Whatever they can think of in their minds, they can do. So we better get down there and scatter them. Because at that point, they were corrupt. They had corrupted themselves. And because they're made in his image and likeness and have been empowered by him, they're going to be able to do a lot of evil things. That was part of the reason why God came down to scatter them in the first place. But it speaks of our creative potential as human beings. What we can accomplish is godlike because we're like God. Now, we were also made to glorify him. So deep down inside of each and every one of us, we have this desire to glorify him. We want to do things to please him, just like our earthly parents. We want to do things to please them. You know, sometimes we strive, you know, for years just to get our parents' attention. Well, what do we want to hear from our parents? We want to hear things like, son, I'm proud of you. Daughter, you make me proud. You know, you're so accomplished, right? We want that. That's part of how God made us. We want to glorify God. We find purpose and meaning in that. Remember the movie Chariots of Fire? Some of you do, all right? So this is the movie that was made around Eric Little in 1924. He had set the gold standard. He won the gold medal, set the world record in running, and they called him the Flying Scotsman. And in the movie, his sister comes to him. He was part of a Christian family who was deeply, deeply embedded, invested in, and involved in missions. And they had all served on the mission field. And so she's upset with her little brother because for her little brother was just wasting his time with like these non-callings, you know, and he's running. I mean, running in games, isn't that what children do? She's like, come on, Eric, you need to grow up. You need to go to the mission field. Our family has a call in their lives. You have a call. The mission field. What are you doing running, right? In fact, his response to her was insightful. He said, I believe that God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. He goes on to tell his sister, look, I'll go to the mission field. But for now, I got to run. Because that's how God made me. And that's where I find his pleasure. I'm thinking, run, Eric, run. Your sister is misguided, misinformed. She thinks of callings only within an ecclesiastical context, as if that's all that matters. The mandate in Genesis is to rule and reign over this world. Everyone has a call. The calls transcend ecclesiology. Your call is what God made you to do. What is it that's deep down inside of you? What is it that God made you to be and made you to do? That's your calling. He found his. It was running. God made him fast. He knew that was a God thing because he felt God's glory when he did it. And look at his testimony that his little sister had overlooked. His mission field was in front of him. His platform was the Olympics. He shared his faith with so many powerful shakers and movers. Untold change came through his testimony. Had he bypassed that and went and did what his little sister thought he ought to do, all of that would have been in vain. Do you realize that he was the greatest runner in his lane or what he did? He was the best. And when they scheduled his event on the Sabbath, which for him was Sunday, he hadn't discovered the Torah yet, but for him it was Sunday, he told them, "I won't run." They said, "It's the Olympics. This is the culmination of your whole life as a runner, and you're going to turn it down." Yeah, you know what he said? He says, "I'm not going to place that before my God. You know, I'm not going to run because my God comes first." Listen to that testimony. Can you imagine how many lives were changed with that? A man of conviction that says, "I'm going to put God first even before what is passionate in my heart." That's amazing in every way. You know what they did? He passed that test. You know what they did? They turned around and said, "Look, this is the greatest runner we've ever saw in this particular event. Let's change the schedule because we got to see him run. We want to see him run. We don't want to miss this either." They changed the schedule of the Olympic event. That was like unbelievable for a man who said, "I won't run because this is a religious conviction." That's amazing in every way. Now I say, Eric, you found your calling. That was your calling, and you fulfilled it well. So what is your calling? What runs deep in your heart? What makes you tick inside? You blow on that. You pray over that. You ask the Father about that. Ask for opportunities to express that. He'll make a way for you. That's your calling. He'll empower you, and you'll bring him glory. Life's too short to miss what you were made to do. And that could be anything in any area of society. Be it a doctor, a firefighter, a teacher, I mean, whatever it is, what makes you tick inside? That's your calling. Run after it. All right. Let's get back to this. So, gender attributes. God made us in his image. And what's his image? Male and female. That's the image of God, male and female. I know we are male and female, but the point I want to make is God is also male and female. How's that so? God has masculine attributes and God has feminine attributes. He is both equally male and female. Sometimes what we do in a patriarchal context is we minimize femininity and kind of brush it to the side. Sometimes even make fun of it. We're dismissive when it comes to women in certain contexts. Or we swing the pendulum all the way over like we've done today, and we say God is a woman, she's female, and we dismiss anything masculine that has to do with God. No, actually, the truth is in the middle. Some say he's neither male nor female. That's totally not true. He's actually male and female, equally so, fully male, fully female. We see these attributes both in Judaism, in mystical Judaism, and in the biblical text. Let me give you an example of this. The Hebrew word for spirit is ruach. It is a feminine noun. A feminine noun. Now that doesn't mean that's not a conclusive way. That doesn't prove conclusively that you know God is also female. But it's part of what builds the case for the concept that God has feminine attributes. So if the spirit is a feminine noun, then Genesis 2 could be translated, could be, Pastor Mark says it should be translated, no, could be. I'm not saying should be, but I want you to consider this. as we establish this idea that God is both male and female. And both Jewish and Christian scholars have commented on this and said, yes, there's certainly a case to be made for this. Whether that should be translated this way or not is still debatable, but here we go. Ready? Genesis 2. The Spirit of God, she was hovering over the face of the waters, like a bird brooding over her nest. The Spirit of God, this feminine noun describing this feminine action, brooding in the Hebrew, the verb is also feminine. So you have the aspect of a mother bird brooding over her nest, caring for her nest, birthing those chicks, watching, protecting, making sure all goes well. This is what we see in Genesis 2. This, I would say, is the feminine attribute of God. Comfort, nurture, mothering. This is what we find in these feminine attributes of God. God is also a king, right? He's a father. He's a king. He's a warrior. He's a killer on the battlefield. Those are masculine traits. He has both masculine and feminine traits. He made us in his image. In the image of God, he made us male and female. So God is revealed as a comforter, not just a warrior, a nurturer, not just a king. Let me give you an example. Isaiah 66. Begin to read this. It says, "For thus says the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river and the glory of the nations like an overflowing stream." He's speaking of Jerusalem. "And you shall nurse." You shall nurse. We all know what nursing is, right? "You shall nurse," listen. "You shall be carried on her hip and bounced on her knees." You know, my father never nursed me. Carried me on his hip, bounced me on his knees. My father didn't do those kind of things. I don't even know where to go with that. But this actually, I think, is in reference to feminine aspects or attributes. That's what a mother does, right? Verse 13, "As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you." Comforting is a mothering aspect. I don't know about you. When I grew up, I hurt myself. I never ran to dad. I learned early on, dad's not a comforter. Okay, dad's not a nurturer. You know, when I hurt myself, you know what my dad did? When I'm in pain, coming to him in pain, he's like, "You know how that happened, son? It's because you did this. I told you not to do that. I told you if you did that, this would happen. And you did that, and that's what happened." I'm like, "Wah," you know. That never happened with mom. Mom never asked me questions. Mom just hugged me, put me on her lap, you know, cut my hand. Mom would get Bactine because it don't sting. My dad would use gasoline, you know, or rubbing alcohol. Thinking, man, give me a shot of scotch. Wouldn't even do that. No nurturing, no comfort. But with my mother, she was the consummate comforter and nurturer. When you think of the role of the Holy Spirit in contrast to the role of the Father and the role of the Son, what do we see? The Holy Spirit is most often referred to as the comforter, the nurturer. Isn't that interesting? Again, the feminine attribute of God seen in the third person of the Trinity. So God is both a mother and a father to us. Now, God has certainly revealed himself primarily as father and secondarily as mother. And the mothering aspect of God tends to stand behind the masculine attributes. And we see that even in the role of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit shows up and says, "I've not come to speak of myself. I've come to exalt Jesus," right? Because that's that whole feminine aspect of God anyway. So, we too are made in the image of God, male or female. We're different, but we fit together well. We complement each other. That's the design of God. In fact, Paul calls marriage a mystery. He says it's the mystery of the nature of God himself. How is that? Well, if the attributes of God are somehow rearranged so that the masculine end up in male and the feminine end up in female, marriage is what brings that back together in perfect harmony. Masculinity and femininity in that oneness of marriage, the mystery of God now fully seen. It's powerful in every way. So in the end, we are male and female. We are both God imagers. We are both made in the likeness and image of God. We represent him as females and as males. We represent him in the natural realm. We are his representations in the natural realm. So let's get back to verse 26 and look at also this issue of dominion as it's tied into the life of God that he's given us. Verse 26, let them, man and woman, male and female, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over their livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Let them have dominion. Let them take dominion. What does that mean? Dominion. Number one, it implies that we have a right to rule and reign over that which God created. Who gets to take dominion? Those who have the authority to rule and reign. And he gave that to us. He's saying, hey, I'm taking care of the heavens. I take care of the spiritual realm. You take care of the natural realm. You're my kids made in my image. You're royals. Rule and reign over the natural realm. Take dominion over everything that's been created. That's our right and our responsibility. God's saying, you know what? Tame this wild earth that I've given to you. And it's wild, isn't it? Anyone garden around here? You know what it's like to garden, right? You got to turn that soil, pull those weeds, you know? Get rid of anything that comes in to destroy the plants. It's work, 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 work. But in the end, what do you have? A beautiful garden. Full of good things to eat and enjoy, right? All that productivity comes from taming the environment, from working the soil. So you got to get out that whip and take care of that wild, untamed environment and bring it under the rule and reign so that you can create something beautiful and productive for everyone to enjoy. That's part of our mandate. That's what we're called to do. And we did that in and through our parents. We did that in the Garden of Eden. And God's saying, now, I want you to do that everywhere. The mandate is, go and do that everywhere. In fact, we get to that, right? He goes on to say in verse 28, and God said to them, he says, and God blessed them. And then I'll get down to the rest of it. But the opening part of this verse is, and God blessed them. The Hebrew word for blessing means to empower one to prosper. So what God's saying is this, I want you to take dominion. And I'm going to give you everything you need to do that. I'm going to give you authority. I'm going to give you power. I'm going to give you wisdom and understanding, knowledge, resources. I'm going to give you everything you need so that you can successfully rule and reign and govern this creation that I've given to you. So we do. We have everything that we need. And he goes on to say in verse 28, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Be fruitful and multiply. Man, I'll tell you what, the heart of God is love. He is love. It's not even an attribute. It's part of his divine essence. He is love. God is love. And the nature of love is to create something that is the same as you. It's on your level. It's not a dog. It's not a cat. It's not a cow. It's not a pet. He created us in his image. When he looked into our eyes, he's seeing himself too. He made us, and then he gave us. The nature of love is you want to give everything that you have to the object of your love. And that reward in seeing their joy is worth it all. And he's saying, that is so incredibly enriching. I want you to do that too. Just like I created, you go. You create in your image. And you work, and you toil, and you raise those kids, slap them down when they need it. But in the end, like me, you'll give them everything. And the joy in their faces will be worth that investment. And it's so true. And I'm so glad to have lived so long as to see my grandkids and to realize it gets better and better and better. Yeah, they're better than kids. And kids are great, but it just gets better and better and better. And you do, for those that are where I'm at, you know that's true, isn't it? They're just everything. You just get you would lay your lives down for them. They just steal your breath. They just steal your heart. They are just everything. And God said, I wanted you to experience that because that's what I experienced. This is the life I've given to you. This is the purpose and the meaning, the mandate, to rule and reign like I rule and reign, to create like I create. In doing so, you're my representatives. You are my people. Subdue the earth. Have dominion over it. First thing we do is we create family. Family is the basis for everything else. If you get marriage right and you get family right, you're going to build a community, a village, a city, a nation. In fact, you'll populate the world. And because the foundation's right, the world's going to be right. But if you get that wrong and out of order, everything else will crumble. People, we are under an incredible attack right now. The attack is on marriage and the family. And this movement today we see in the protests, it's all about disassembling the family, redefining the family. They've already done that with marriage. Now they're doing it with the family. Because if you can break all that down and create chaos, which that's exactly what's happening, then you can flip our constitutional republic into a Marxist state. And that's what they're after. That's the plan of the enemy. This is the enemy trying to pervert everything that God has given to us in order to rob and steal the life of God in the design of marriage and family and neighborhoods and nations that are whole and healthy. He wants to steal all that. He wants to ruin it and take it from us. We have a fight on our hands, and the fight is fought when we return to God and his ways and take a stand for life and all that it means. So the final thing he does, which is super, super interesting, by the way, just super interesting, is the final thing he does before he rests on the Sabbath is he gives some very important instructions. Instructions that, by and large, we have ignored as a people group. Not the harvest, but we as a people group. Genesis 1, 29 through 31. And God said, behold, I've given you every grain plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. Slide 68. The diet before the fall was a nutrient-dense, organic, plant-based diet. Why is that important to God? Why is that such a big thing to God? Is God concerned with what we eat? When we think of our bodies in a Hebraic context, they are very important. In a Greek model where you have dualism, the body's not important. The spirit is. That's all that matters. So it doesn't matter what you do with the body, because the body's going to perish. In Judaism, in the Torah, that's not true. The body's going to be raised. The body is as important as the soul. In fact, the body without the soul, what good is the soul without the body? And vice versa. Now, our bodies are going to be resurrected. We're going to come back into our bodies. Our bodies are important. Plus, they're integrated. They're an integrated whole. When I have the flu and I'm sick and hurting and every bone in my body is aching, right? I don't feel very spiritual. Well, I can't even share that. Just know that if you're around me when I am very, very sick, I'm not nice to be around, right? It impacts everything about me. That's so true. We're an integrated whole. Can you imagine this? If we don't care about what we eat and we eat things that are not really good and things that God said shouldn't even be eaten, ultimately they're going to work themselves out in chronic illnesses. Yeah, so God says, be careful. Sustain your body. Be responsible with your bodies. This is your diet. Now, of course, God introduced meat into the diet. Yes, he did. When? After the flood. At the same time, when he changed that, he took our lifespans from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years long down to 70. That was the average. I mean, there was a part of the consequence of the sin in Genesis 6 was God would extremely limit our lifespans. Now they're down to 70 years average. Do you know that most chronic illnesses, once you introduce meat into the diet, in a balanced diet, you start to see the chronic illnesses at 50, 60, 70? Yeah. This is an assumption, but I think God was saying, look, you can eat meat now because it doesn't matter. You're all dying around 70 anyway. Doesn't really matter. Now, if you're going to live 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 900 years, you'd never make it with any animal products in your diet. Never make it that long. Okay? But now everything's down to 70, so it doesn't really matter. Have some meat. Now, we went from having some meat to let's eat meat as the main staple of our diet, right? And let's make sure it's the kind that comes from the very animals we shouldn't be eating anyway. And as a result, we are a very sick nation. In fact, the church is a very sick organization as well as a result of ignoring God's instructions concerning diet. So all of this is to say that our bodies are important. The earth is important. We're to be responsible caretakers and sustainers of not only our environments, our agriculture, the animals, but we're also to be responsible with what we eat. You say, well, I'm under grace. Well, good. I'm under grace too. We can both eat Big Macs and drink chocolate malts and have French fries every day because we're under grace. You know what that means? It means we're still saved. We're just going to get to the kingdom a little bit sooner, decades sooner than what God had planned. It's called a premature death. And obviously that is not God's plan. But God clearly states, I'm not going to be mocked by my children. When a man soweth, that also shall he reap. So let's not test God in those things. Let's try to be responsible with what God has given us. Now, Don, would you give me that book, please, on the front? Yeah, thank you. So two books I wanted to recommend that you get and read, and some of you, most of you have read these books, but if you haven't, the first one's called Holy Cow, Does God Care What We Eat? By a Messianic Jewish woman named Hope Egan. She does a great job with the food lists and the design of food, both from the organic plant-based diets to integrating what God allows for meat consumption, and does that in a very balanced way. I think it's a great book, a good place to start. God has a lot to say about what's appropriate to eat and what's not appropriate for those whom he has saved. And then also, the other book is called Eat for Life. It's just been published by Dr. Joel Fuhrman in March of this year. It's his newest book. Fantastic book. You can get that on Amazon.com. It also shows you how to structure a good, healthy diet to maximize and optimize your well-being physically. And just like I said earlier, our physical lives are important because when they are not doing well, neither are we doing well spiritually. It's all related. So in summary, life is a gift. It is the gift of God. It is sacred. It is to be cherished, nurtured, protected, and defended by all. We are made in the image of God. We are made in the likeness of God. There's only two biological genders, male and female. Yes, there's about 1% of the human population that has both sexes within their biology. That's due to genetic defects. Those do happen. That's also a part of the consequences of our fallen world that we live in. But that does not in any way change the fact that there are only two biological genders, male and female. God has both masculine and feminine attributes. He's both a father and a mother. And we reflect that in our own nature as men and women, male and female, different but yet complementary to one another. We also have a mandate and a mission: rule and reign over the natural realm on earth as God rules and reigns over heaven in the spiritual realm. You and I are called to rule and reign. We're the governors. We're the ones that govern. Our constitutional republic was the first of its kind. It got it right. It went back to Genesis. Our Declaration of Independence makes it clear that we all have a creator, that we were all created equal in his image, and that we have these inalienable rights, which include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They understood that we would govern ourselves by the laws of nature and nature's God. This is revolutionary when you think about it. It allows the believer for the first time in history to actually rule and reign over the earth as God intended it. That's what we have. That's what we need to fight for. That is how we rule and reign with Christ on earth as he rules and reigns in heaven. This is everything, people. Sin, it messed it all up. The fall, the original sin, is what really changed everything forever. As a result, we were alienated, confused, thrown into chaos, perversion, misery, violence, and ultimately death. In Romans, it says this, Romans 5, 12 through 17. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. When sin entered in, it changed everything. We are alienated from God. We pursued our own ways. We chose the bad rather than the good. And everything that ensued was miserable and ultimately ended in violence and death. And this has been the way of the world ever since, ever since. The remedy is found in verse 15. But the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, speaking of Adam and Eve's fall, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. Through one man, sin entered in, and through sin, death entered in. But God sent his Son because he loved the world. And as a result, life is abounding to many, to all who would believe. What we lost in Eden is now being restored in Jesus Christ, including the mission and the mandate to rule and reign. If we don't pick up that banner, if we don't run with that mission, others from the other side will rise up and rule and reign over us. Romans 5:17. For if, because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. The grace of God has come to us. The offer of life has come to us. Life with all of its purpose and meaning being given to us, including co-creating with God, ruling and reigning with God on earth as he rules and reigns from heaven. Did you catch that in the last part of this verse? It says, the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Our life is qualified by ruling and reigning with Christ. That's our mission. That's our mandate. We are royals. We are rulers. We are kings and queens. The earth is ours and everything that is in it. We need to assert ourselves to bring the gospel, the grace of God to everyone, to show the world what it looks like when righteous people rule and reign. Righteous, not perfect people, righteous people, not perfect people. But once you experience the rule and the reign of the wicked, you can see how sharp the line of demarcation is. We are called to rule and reign with Christ. That is part of the gospel. That's part of the mandate that the gospel restores to us. I'm going to close with John chapter 10, 7 through 10. So Jesus again said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. So the metaphor of the kingdom is that of a shepherd and a sheep. And Jesus is saying, I am that shepherd. I'm the door to the field. And you know, sheep, they get penned up at night because of predators. That's what shepherds do. They pen them up, hem them in, usually against a hillside with rocks. And then in the morning, man, those sheep, they can't wait to get out. They don't want to be bunched up. They want to be free to run around and jump and eat and play and explore the world of the field, right? What does Jesus say? He says, I'm the one that releases them. I'm the one that gives to them that which is meaningful and purposeful. I am the one. And in me, they will go in and out and find meaning and purpose. They'll find satisfaction. That's what life is. He closes with this. Verse 10. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. The thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy. We can see the nature of the thief in our protests today, can't you? What are they doing? They come to rob, steal, spread their violence, rape and murder in our streets, burning things down. What is going on? That is the work of the enemy. This is a wicked work of the enemy. Jesus says, I came to give you life and life abundantly. Are you having trouble finding meaning and purpose, peace and joy? It's in me. Come to me, all ye who are heavy laden. I'll give you rest. I'll give you peace. I'll give you meaning. I'll prosper you. Yet the world has it all backwards. And through envy and lust, they run around like wild animals, stealing and pillaging and wrecking everything around them. People, we have the answer for what the nation needs. We need to continue to let our light shine, just assert yourself, love on people, breathe hope into them, share the gospel, stand for life. Realize that what Jesus has given to you, that life, that abundant life, is worth protecting. It's worth defending. And our republic, our free republic, is one of the very few nations around the planet where you and I have the opportunity to truly rule and reign and govern ourselves under the laws of nature and nature's God. It's precious. We need to understand what's at risk. We need to band together, pray together, stand together, and make a difference in a time in which our nation is at a crossroads. And we will make that difference. Shabbat shalom.
Receive now the name of Yahweh.
Yivarech Yahweh v'yishmarech Ya'er Yahweh panav elech v'yichunech Yisi Yahweh panav elech v'yasem lech shalom.
B'shem Yeshua HaMashiach, Sar Shalom, Shabbat Shalom.